as well as the love of my family, didn't keep me a boy, but it gave me the courage to know that if I did come out, it would be okay. Love didn't enable me to stay a man. It was love that enabled me finally to tell the truth. Responding to advocates for allowing children with persistent gender dysphoria to transition, the bioethicist Alice Domorot-Dredger wrote, "Changing a kid's name and gender identification at the age of 5 or 6? This approach takes gender claims of little children so seriously that it's actually beholden to a ridiculously strict notion of gender. The great majority of young children who declare that they are a gender that doesn't match their birth sex grow out of the mismatch. Young girls who declare in word or behavior that they are boys end up all over the place, which at some level proves to me that most really are females. Sex-changing interventions are non-trivial. They involve substantial physical risk, including major risk to sexual sensation, and a lifelong commitment to trying to manage hormone replacement. The problem is us, and the way we demand certainty from them, the way we insist on confirmation to a two-sex model as early as possible." Josie Romero and Tony Ferriolo were adamant about who they were almost from infancy. Jenny Boylan knew but tried to repress the knowledge. But many others are deeply confused. Parents must determine whether such children are in a transient obsession or expressing a fundamental identity. They must guess what will make their child happy when he or she is grown, and how best to accomplish this. These balances are hard for parents to achieve, to supervise without presiding over, to caution but not demand, to impel but not insist, to protect but not throttle. Parents must take care not to squash their children's identity, nor to build it up so much that they need to create the truth to which they intend to respond. In "Mom, I Need to Be a Girl," Just Evelyn wrote of her child, "I knew his life would be difficult and sad. How could a mother help? And would a mother's love be enough?" Many parents are willing to do what it takes for their children to be happy, but it isn't always possible to know what it takes. Abrupt, decisive transformation occurs regularly in fairy tales, fantasy literature, and comic books, but not in most real lives, where change tends to be gradual and incomplete. In her memoir, The Woman I Was Born to Be, trans woman Alicia Brevard writes, "I consciously tried to create a boy child who might be worthy of love. Painstakingly, I tried to mimic the acceptable traits of other males around me. I knew, and so did my daddy, that the mimicry was a sham." In her poignant book, Transparent, Chris Beam writes about a Latino trans girl who named herself Ariel after the heroine of The Little Mermaid. Ariel had to go talk to her father, who turned her into a human being for real, the girl explained. "I want to go through the story just the way Ariel did, turning into a real girl and getting the guy. But struggling to become who you've always been and be loved anyway is a continuous process, usually marked with ambivalence." Hendrik and Alexia Koos grew up in South Africa and emigrated to Canada shortly before the end of apartheid, choosing a fairly small community where Hendrik's abilities as a GP might prove valuable. Both parents knew that their eldest daughter, Sari, was unhappy. She'd been diagnosed with ADD, a learning disability, and an anxiety disorder. When she announced at 14 that she had the wrong body, Hendrik was terribly upset. It seemed like just another stab in the dark. When we spoke, a little more than a year had passed since Sari had become Bill, and Hendrik seemed to be holding his feelings just in check. We started reading And we found out that there were guidelines and ages, and he was younger than these guidelines, and he was really pressuring us, Hendricks said. I almost felt impotent as a parent. What was I supposed to do? I could say, you're a kid. You have to be patient. Or I could listen to my child. I've never wanted to pressure my children. My best dream for them is to be themselves. But I was so worried, I was exhausted by it. Bill himself was anxious and ambivalent, and that made everything harder. I had become interested in interviewing Hendrick after hearing him question the adult trans people on a panel. They were so self-confident, so full of, I am who I am, he said to me. People said, once your child can be who he is, you'll see a new person. Hendrick laughed. No, it was a few steps forward, a few steps back. Overall, the steps forward are more, but it's an ongoing fight to gain good ground. Hendrick said he derived resilience from being a doctor. From medicine, I learned to understand that life has challenges without always understanding where they come from. I felt, I'm not going to try to remedy my child's mind. Hendrick's second source of strength was even more striking. As a white person coming of age in apartheid, I wanted to get rid of racism in my life, and sexism, and genderism too. My South African experience was a preparation for learning to say, I accept you for everything. Although Hendrick Kuse's kind openness was different from Rex and Karen Butt's visceral enthusiasm, their children experienced similar ambivalence. Rex and Karen didn't believe in gendering childhood. They brought up their two sons with a toy kitchen and read to them from Letty Cotton Pogrebin's Stories for Free Children. When I had a baby shower, I didn't want blue or pink, Karen said. We had yellow and green. They told their sons that women could do anything men could do. Elementary school was lonely for their son Jared. High school was rocky, and Haverford College was not the revelation he had hoped for. One of his friends set him up on a blind date with a girl from Bryn Mawr, with whom he had his first kiss and his first relationship. The relationship entailed sexual expectations that were alien to Jared, and one night his girlfriend walked in on him wearing her clothes. He said, I think life would be a lot easier for me if I was a girl. She replied, Oh, honey, you can't be a girl, not with that nose. It was said in a tone of fun, but Jared sank into a severe depression. He had won every academic prize at his high school and was valedictorian. Now he was flunking. He had no sex life and almost no social life. He dropped out and moved home. 3 months later, he said to his parents, I think I'm gay. He went out on his first date with a guy, and he realized he wasn't gay. He nonetheless decided to attend an LGBT conference for high school kids, partly because he felt as though he had stopped growing up and was in effect still a high school student, even at 22. He dropped into the Transgender 101 panel. 2 days later, he and his mother were out shopping, and he asked her to pull over so he could tell her something. It's something big, isn't it? She said. He told her he was trans, that was his life path. She said, Oh, why would anybody want to be a woman? It can be so hard being a woman. Later that day, he asked his family to gather so he could tell them. He said he was willing to lose people in his life over it. His younger brother, Chad, said, That's bullshit. Anybody who would leave your life over this never was really in your life in the first place. Rex said, I've been so worried about your being depressed. I don't know what the hell trans means, but at least you're not irretrievable to me. Jared became Cadence Case. She explained to me, It's a measure of how supportive my parents were, that my father's first question was, Are you going to be okay if we have to save up to pay for this? When I met Cadence, 8 years after she began transition, she was 30 and lingering in an intermediate territory. She had long hair, male typical fat distribution, a tall, lanky body, and no breasts. She wore earrings and gender-neutral clothes. She had endured months of electrolysis, but had more to go. Her only surgery was a nose job. I asked how she had seemed before transition. "I was intelligent, compassionate, and not macho," she said. "I never came off as feminine, and I doubt I ever will. And I don't really have a problem with that. I've reached an accommodation where I don't hate myself. If you have a spectrum of gender, I'm 60, maybe 65% toward female." Outsiders tend to think of the urgent surgery as being genital, but that is often not the feeling of trans people. "Facial surgery is the gateway to living full-time," Cadence said. Rex and Karen had found surgeons for genital procedures, but Cadence didn't call them. Her parents interpreted her delay not as reluctance, but as unhappiness. "For a long time, she was too depressed to deal with it," her mother explained. Rex said wryly, "We're more in a hurry than she is sometimes." Karen was reprimanded by the head of the school where she taught for talking about Cadence's transition where she could be overheard, and she was furious. "No one tells me not to talk about my kid," she said. Rex said, "I'm more activist about this than I've been about anything. It really is how I identify myself." Rex and Karen co-founded a local chapter of PFLAG, Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, a group that now includes families of trans people. "When I last saw them, they had just been invited to be grand marshals of the 2009 Mid-Hudson Gay Pride Parade." Rex asked the board president why they would want them in such a role, and she wrote back, "Because you love your child." Caden said, "I think they're more comfortable with my being trans now than I am. They're just far left, while I'm radically farther left. But I don't do as much about it." Parents such as Rex and Karen encourage their children to use therapy to explore gender issues. Others, though, turn to therapy in the hope of deterring such exploration. The choice of approach will depend not only on the child's needs, but also on the parents. Reparative therapies, psychological, religious, sometimes biological, remain ubiquitous, and the parents who seek such treatment for their children are generally motivated by sincere convictions. Stephanie Brill said, "Everybody loves their children, but they have different ideas of how to help them." She encourages parents to meet other parents and find a new normal that includes their experience. They don't have to condone their child's wearing nail polish. "It's not about arguing about what's appropriate in church," she said. "It's about expressing love, which is reassuring to the child, and also, actually, to the parent." People whose lives have been bound by strong gender conventions, however, often believe that hewing to social norms will protect their children from abuse in the world. That very notion can constitute abuse inside the family. Jonah and Lily Marks live in New Jersey, within commuting distance of New York, but said that they did not know anyone who was gay, much less anyone who was trans. Nothing they said indicated that their son, Caleb, wanted to be a girl. He did not insist on wearing dresses, did not hate his body, had never said he was female. When I suggested a therapist who could help Caleb figure himself out, Lily said, "I need to find someone who persuades people not to have a sex change operation. That's all I can think about. Now it's third grade. The boys get tougher. The girls don't really want to play with boys anymore." But then Lily recounted. One of the moms said, when we got the class list, my daughter put a thumbs down for every boy except Caleb. So he's not weird enough that no one likes him. Occasional teasing seemed not to bother Caleb much. It bothered his parents, who were challenged imagining a happiness so different from their own. He hates team sports, Lily said, but he loves to boogie board, ice skate, and swim, and he dives competitively. Jonah said, he's a very happy boy, very comfortable in his own skin. He likes ceramics and photography, but he won't do Little League or use a urinal. Lily said, he has almost no male friendships. Middle school could only be worse. My daughter torments him. You're acting like a girl. Stop acting weird. Constantly. Lily and Jonah had decided to get their children a puppy and described how Caleb had responded by jumping up and down gleefully and effeminately. Jonah said, he's not familiar with how to be excited, because he's never been in an environment with other boys who have won a game together. Caleb went to sleepaway camp and loved it. He had starring roles in both musicals that summer. He loved the counselor who directed them. When we met the counselor, he had on a tight purple t-shirt, skinny jeans, and purple Converse sneakers, Lily said. Definitely out of the box. Caleb came home asking for these clothes. I was not buying him purple sneakers. I have to protect him. I wondered about enrolling him in a local theater program. I will not play into that, Lily said. Jonah added, he's got a tremendous physique. He could excel at whatever sport, but he just doesn't have the interest. There's only so much that Lily and I can do to shelter him from what will inevitably be broader ridicule for how he is. Both parents showed considerable anxiety about a future that they viewed as nearly inevitable. I mean, he likes one boy, Lily said, shortly after telling me that all his friends were girls. If you looked at this kid, you would think football player. He's big and tall. But he's very much like Caleb, doesn't play sports. Then there's this one other boy that he's very good friends with. His name is Carl, and he's very athletic. But when's he going to ditch Caleb? Because he's a cool kid, Carl. We love him. So I'm just wondering when it's not going to be okay to be friends with the weird kid. Lily wondered if Caleb's unwillingness to play catch or shoot baskets with his father was connected to his awareness that he's not living up to Jonah's expectations. I personally think that he knows he's disappointed Jonah, Lily said. If I asked him to go have a catch, he would. If I asked him to shoot baskets, he would. Jonah said, which begs the question as to why you don't. Lily said, with the dignity of her gender and no touch of irony, because I don't shoot baskets and play catch. Caleb had never been trans, but he was mildly gender-variant. He came out as gay at 13 and almost immediately made a suicide attempt. Sometimes, one becomes fully visible only through catastrophe. Caleb's adolescent despair spurred his parents to renounce efforts to resolve his childhood aberrance. They acknowledged clearly that he was always lovable and loved, and began the steep climb toward rebuilding his battered ego and their own. Reparative therapies for gay people are now deemed unethical by most professionals. But whether reparative therapies for trans people should be regarded the same way is widely debated. Among the most controversial figures in the field is Kenneth J. Zucker, psychologist-in-chief and head of the Gender Identity Service at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, who continues to hold considerable sway and was appointed in 2008 to lead the DSM-5 Task Force on GID. Zucker contends that natal girls who are trans see their mothers as disenfranchised and therefore wish to be men, while natal boys wish to draw close to detached mothers by becoming girls. Activists believe that the high rate of depression in children denied the right to transition is the result of their struggle to conform. Zucker believes that the wish to switch genders is a symptom of underlying depression. The hypothesis that GID sometimes has social and family origins can be defended. Zucker's views on how to treat GID are much less robust. The Conservative Catholic Education Resource Center and the National Association for Research and Therapy of Homosexuality, NARTH, are both indebted to Zucker's work, though they overlay it with Christian ideology. Using techniques derived from the models Phyllis Burke critiques in Gender Shock, Zucker instructs parents to model gender roles, pushing these mothers and fathers into behavior consistent with mid-century gender stereotypes. He then asks that they impound cross-gender toys and prevent cross-dressing. Friendships with members of the same gender are to be encouraged, and cross-gender friendships are to be halted. One mother described confiscating Barbies and unicorns from a child who, when given trucks, simply refused to play. When he reverted to drawing, his parents were to take away the pink and purple crayons and insist that he draw boys. In the end, his mother said, he was leading a double life, acting like a boy in front of her and escaping into a girl world whenever he could. Zucker claims that no patient who began seeing him by 6 has switched gender. He recently announced that a follow-up study of 25 girls he first saw in childhood showed only 3 with persistent gender dysphoria later in life. At the same time, because adolescents are less malleable than children, Zucker will sometimes recommend hormones and surgery for people who come to him later. He does so with regret. Many of Zucker's patients have determined to live in their birth gender at the end of his therapy, but a recent article in the Atlantic Monthly quoted the mother of a Zucker-treated child who doubted her adult daughter, an alcoholic and self-mutilator, would outlive her. It seems overreaching to call this a success. Stephanie Brill said, "In my experience with many people who come to us after seeing Zucker, his work can alter gender expression, but it does not touch gender identity." The question is whether trans people, like most gay people, have a fixed identity that only a fool would try to alter, or whether a child born male who says he is really female is like, in Zucker's simile, a child born black who insists he is white and needs to be eased into accepting himself. Zucker points to the rigid way many trans children adopt the stereotypes of the opposite gender. "There is no joy in their play," he said. "They're struggling, experiencing social ostracism and difficulty establishing friendships with children of their own gender." Zucker feels that the idea of GID as a natal condition, not subject to repair, is simple-minded biological reductionism. The therapists who support early transition are, in his words, liberal essentialists. He explained, "Liberals have always been critical of biological reductionism, but here they embrace it. I think that conceptual approach is astonishingly naive and simplistic, and I think it's wrong." Susan Coates, former head of the Childhood Gender Identity Project at Roosevelt Hospital in New York, agrees. She said, "I've seen about 350 kids with gender issues. They are fundamentally creative, and part of the creativity allowed them to imagine solving their problems by switching gender. My experience is that no one becomes transgender who had treatment early. If you work on separation anxiety and aggression, the gender problem starts to fall away. Anxiety is what leads to gender dysphoria." Zucker and Coates are accomplished academics who have personal integrity, but, like some of the activists who attack them, they seem to imply that universals exist in a field of highly varied stories. You can damage someone who is trans by preventing him or her from living in his or her true gender. You can damage someone who has GID but will not be trans by trapping him or her in an ill-fitting cross-gender identity. The trans-friendly therapist Michelle Angelo said, "Parents tell me often, and it's sort of PC, that they are following their child's lead. If your child is 7, you probably don't let them choose what they're going to eat for dinner, let alone if they're going to transition to a new gender. There is a very, very occasional phenomenon where the parents have their own mental health issues and their kid is not the most masculine male, so they've decided that their child is trans. The kid isn't transgender and is being talked into it." Stephanie Brill said, "It's important not to overdiagnose transgender children. That's a very small part of the gender variant population." When Dolores Martinez was 14 and still a boy named Diego, living in Massachusetts, his mother caught him with his first boyfriend. "I was in a miniskirt doing the dirty," Dolores said. "I put on my boy clothes again and went downstairs, and she said, 'Your father said to be out or he's going to kill you.' I was on the streets for 4 years, and I was convicted of a major violent crime and sent to prison. It saved my life. I spent almost 4 years in prison, happier than ever before. When you're in there, either you're a man or they'll turn you into a woman. So I was a sister. That was my first experience at being myself 100%. After she was released, Dolores learned that her mother had lied. She told my father I ran away. When he found out what she'd done, that was their divorce. When I told him about my transition, he said, 'Oh, thank God.'" Dolores spent 10 years in therapy before her first hormone shot. Eventually, she met Gustav Prell, a trans man who was the love of her life, and they were legally married. Under the law, however, she was a man, and he was a woman. When Tyler Holmes was a confused little girl named Serena, she wished for boy parts, but didn't really wish to be a boy. She had a brief relationship with a 16-year-old, Freddie Johnson, and became pregnant. When their son, Louis, was born, Freddie expressed little interest. But when Louis was 2, Freddie's mother began complaining to the Department of Social Services about Serena. Louis's guardian ad litem, assigned to look after the child's interests, told Serena to sign something. "I didn't know what it was, and I signed it. And it turned out it was for custody," Tyler said. "I lost my child." When Serena befriended Gustav Prell and Dolores Martinez soon thereafter, she began to question her allegiance to her own gender. When she was hospitalized for endometriosis, her doctor said it could be treated with an estrogen-based medication. But Serena said that she'd prefer treatment with testosterone, that she really wanted facial hair and a lower voice. She began calling herself Tyler. One Thursday in 2008, Gustav, who had always been depressive, went to the emergency room of a local hospital seeking admission because he was suicidal. He was told that no beds were available to a transgender person. He hanged himself 2 days later, age 27. Dolores filed a complaint, but the Board of Mental Health found the hospital not at fault. Because transgender people are not a protected class, the ruling stated, the hospital had discretion to refuse them admission if their presence might disturb other patients. After Gustav was gone, it seemed natural for Tyler and Dolores to get together. I asked whether the fact that neither of them had made a surgical transition had any bearing on their attraction. Tyler said, "Love and relationships aren't based on what you have underneath your clothes, what pronouns you go by, or the name you use. With Dolores, it's based on the person she is and the way I feel about her, and the person I am and the way she feels about me. Dolores has expressed wanting some form of surgery at some point, but that's her thing as far as when or what she wants. Dolores said, I see Tyler as a boy with benefits. He straps it on so I can select a size. In the 5 years since Tyler relinquished custody, Louis, now 7, has lived with his paternal grandmother. Tyler and Dolores are allowed to see Louis only once a week for a supervised visit. Tyler said he didn't think Louis had noticed his transition. I felt that Tyler's full beard might have clued Louis in, not to mention Dolores' habit of addressing him with male pronouns. Both Tyler and Dolores were interested in Louis's gendered behavior. Dolores said, Louis could be like my husband was, where he was a girl one day and a boy the next. He likes My Little Ponies, which we have to sneak into him because he's not allowed any girl toys. I'm not a doctor, but I think he's genderqueer right now. Tyler said, he's never said anything about being trans or wanting to be a girl, but I never said anything when I was little. It seemed to me that absent any assertion from Louis that he wanted to be a girl, he was probably not trans. He did, however, do badly with male stereotypes. He inhabited a polarized world with either a terrifying genderlessness or an oppressive genderedness. He might not know for sure that he's a girl, Tyler said. He might not know for sure that he's a boy. He might float back and forth from day to day, and that's okay, too. I don't want him to lose 25 years of his life like I did. Perhaps the immutable error of parenthood is that we give our children what we wanted, whether they want it or not. We heal our wounds with the love we wish we'd received, but are often blind to the wounds we inflict. Dolores said, I want Louis to be comfortable with himself, whether he's a male, female, somewhere in the middle. I have a lot more years to fix than a youngster. My life is not what I want for him. Children should be able to be themselves. They also want rules and boundaries. And I feared that Dolores and Tyler's infinitely permissive idea of love might be petrifying to a child. The longing of a child is to be seen. And once the child is seen, he or she wants to be loved for a true self. Dolores and Tyler were full of love, unnuanced by seeing. He's the most beautiful boy that I've ever seen, and probably the most beautiful child on the planet, for all I know, Tyler said. It's cool, because it's almost like I'm transitioning with my son. He has it a little bit better than most trans kids, because he has 2 trans parents. We're not going to let him do it by himself, like our parents did. He has people who will go with him. Dolores said, his transition needs to move forward. I see him living in my yesterday, so hopefully he can learn from my tomorrow. The debate over gender identity was once framed as a nature-nurture divide. Nowadays, it's an intractable-tractable divide, which is equally hard to call. Clearly nature is involved, but the question is whether nurture enables it, whether it can and should disable it. The answers are frustratingly vague. Psychodynamics has proposed a range of contradictory explanations for cross-gender identification. As Amy Bloom wryly pointed out in her book Normal, it's either absent fathers and over-involved mothers, or dominant fathers and submissive mothers. It's parents who encourage cross-gender identification and play, or who forbid and thereby mystify cross-gender identification and play. Some little boys may want to wear dresses because they have brutal fathers who scare them and loving mothers with whom they identify. Others may have a condition determined by genetics, brain development, or the uterine environment. Transitioning is still bound up with the medical and therapeutic communities. In the best cases, This means that responsible professionals can separate the fears and desires of the parents from those of their offspring, and distinguish between an immutable imperative and a transient neurosis. That can, however, be daunting. Separating the psychiatric, the endocrine, and the neurocognitive seems almost poignantly old-fashioned. Modern psychiatry seeks the chemical pathways of emotional and thought disorders, but attempts to distinguish mind from brain are still primitive, and a condition as complex as GID must be described from multiple angles at once. Heino Meyer-Balberg, who serves on the DSM committee, acknowledged that the description of GID cannot be achieved on a purely scientific basis. In his own practice, Meyer-Balberg believes that transition is best avoided if possible. "It's terrible to mutilate a healthy body and make someone infertile," he said. "Sexual functioning is not terrific even in the best cases, and is horrific in the worst. There is some feeling that you're enhancing a disorder rather than treating it." He believes in a centrist treatment. "We try to introduce them to more of their same-sex peers," he said, "and if their fathers have already turned into sissy boy-hating distant fathers, as happens in this homophobic country, we try to get them to re-engage positively and to develop a relationship. Many of these children become more comfortable in their birth gender, and even if they don't, they can have a broader circle of friends and experiences." That said, he has also put children on puberty blockers as early as 11. "Sometimes I help patients make the change, and sometimes, in a non-coercive fashion, I try to stop them from doing so," he said. "It's only based on my own intuition. I have no algorithm." Edgardo Menvier said, "Most young children don't come with a claim about their identity. They are brought because they are different in their gender expression. Whether they should transition or not, you're never really sure you're doing the right thing." Members of the trans community often fear therapists who steer children away from their true selves. Parents are more likely to fear that their children will have surgery and come to regret it. It is impossible to know how many people who have transitioned socially but not physically have transitioned back. We do know, however, that as many as 1 in 100 people who have had sex reassignment surgery wish they had not done so. Danielle Berry, born Dan Bunton, underwent sex reassignment surgery in 1992 at 43, in what she later described as a midlife crisis. She subsequently said, "I'm now concerned that much of what I took as a gender dysfunction might have been nothing more than a neurotic sexual obsession. I was a cross-dresser for all of my sexual life, and had always fantasized going femme as an ultimate turn-on. I just wish I would have tried more options before I jumped off the precipice." The Iraqi-born Sam Hashimi underwent sex reassignment surgery in England after his wife left him in 1997. "Trudy had never worked a day of her life," he said. "She'd think nothing of spending a few £1,000 on a dress. I always used to wonder what it would be like to have none of the responsibility I had, to have doors open for me and all the privileges a woman seems to have." So he became Samantha Kane. But Samantha found being a woman rather shallow and limiting, and decided she'd made a terrible mistake. She underwent a painful and unsatisfactory reversal of her genital surgery, and after adopting the new name, Charles, sued the psychiatrist who had supported the surgical transition. Such stories are unfortunately used to discredit the trans movement as a whole. Cases of profound post-surgical regret make headlines, while much less space is given to people who would have been much happier with a full surgical transition, but were never able to achieve one. Mistakes will be made in both directions, and lives can be ruined either way. Some children who are supported in conforming to a chosen gender identity may later feel trapped by it. Their parents and doctors may make misguided decisions about hormone blockers, hormones, or surgery. Other children, not supported for transition, live and die in despair. It is terrible to perform unnecessary surgery on a healthy body, but it is also terrible to deny succor to a mind that knows itself. Far more boys are referred for treatment for GID than girls. However, this does not mean that more natal boys have gender atypical behavior than natal girls, only that they worry their parents more. Feminism won for women many rights formerly reserved for men. Girls who are aggressive and dominant are often admired. The very word tomboy has a measure of fondness built into it, though there is no shortage of insults for assertive women. In contrast, no movement seeks to legitimize stereotypically feminine traits in men. Girls can be masculine, boys are effeminate. Girls in jeans and t-shirts wear unisex clothing, but boys in skirts are in drag. Kim Pearson described asking everyone in a parents' group who had been a tomboy to raise her hand. Hands went up all over the room. She then asked everyone who had been a sissy to raise his hand. No one stirred. When Scott Earle was a tomboy named Anne Marie, her parents regarded her toughness as a sign of strength. They were both pediatricians living in liberal Vermont. I loved the idea of having a woman unencumbered by limits, Lynn Luganbuhl, Scott's mother, said. Gender irregularities were plentiful in Scott's early life. As a little girl, Anne Marie had this beautiful curly blonde hair, Scott's father, Morris, said. One morning, we got up and Anne Marie, who was 18 months old, was in her older brother Ben's room, and Ben, maybe 5, had cut off all her hair. Ben got in trouble, but later I wondered if Anne Marie somehow asked for it. Lynn said, "We had this pink down snowsuit." My mother said to Anne Marie, age 4, "Oh, you're a beautiful pink lady in that snowsuit." Anne Marie refused to put it on. We finally dyed it black, and then she would wear it. In Anne Marie's first conversation with other trans people online, when she was 14, the name Scott emerged, and she realized that was what she wanted to be called. A few months later, her parents returned from a party to find a letter on their dresser. "Dear Mommy and Daddy, I have to be a guy. I'm trans." Morris recalled, "I didn't even know what that word meant. We walked downstairs to the basement where Scott was watching TV, and I said, 'Is there anything that would make us not think you're one of the greatest people we ever met?'" Lynn called some gay friends for advice, but they knew no more about being trans than she did. "I found a therapist who helped make people less inclined to transition physically," she said. Scott hated her. "I had to come to an understanding that he really was going to live as a guy. We eventually found a therapist who had counseled 70 transgender people, and she felt Scott didn't need to see her because he was so clear. I thought I was raising this strong woman, but most 8-year-old girls do not wear boys' underwear." For Morris, the challenge to accepting Scott's new identity wasn't a conservative belief in an unbreachable wall between maleness and femaleness, but a utopian belief that no natural disparity exists between genders, which made transition pointless. But he didn't fight Scott's wishes. "If there's a snowstorm, you don't spend time trying to get it to go away," he said. They called their local endocrinologist at the University of Vermont, UVM, where they were both referring physicians, and he said he didn't deal with such cases. Lynn was shocked. "As pediatricians, when we take care of people, We need to leave our opinions at the door, she said. Our job is to meet people on their terms. This was no different. She eventually found a trans health group in Philadelphia, drove Scott 7 hours down, went to the appointment, and drove straight back. In testimony before the Vermont Senate on trans rights years later, Lynn said, I think what is hard is when you don't know what to do, or when there is nothing you can do. It was very clear that there were lots of things to do. So we just did them. Scott, academically advanced, was boarding at St. Paul's, a New England prep school. Lynn drove him back after Christmas break. They stopped at a gas station, and when Scott used the men's room, his mother realized how far along he was. When he came out as trans at a school assembly shortly after his return, he was greeted with support from other students and much of the faculty, but not from the school administration, led by an ostensibly broad-minded Episcopal bishop. He told Lynn that her daughter needed to grow out of this, and suggested that Scott might have a better time starting fresh in a new place. I knew he was just trying to get rid of me, Scott said, so he left. He met up with trans people on the internet, then in real life. He dyed his hair blue and got a mohawk. He said he didn't care about academics and might not finish his education. Lynn said to him, Look, we've worked really hard to respect you and let you be who you are, and now we're asking you to finish school and go to college. Scott agreed it was a fair bargain. Lynn suggested that he go to college early and register as a guy. UVM was eager to have him, so in what would have been his junior year of high school, he became a freshman in college. Morris took Scott to freshman orientation. He was wearing a t-shirt from some trans event, Morris said. I was thinking, if you want to be a guy, be a guy, but don't go wear this trans shirt and look all weird. We got to the orientation, and a number of the volunteers said, Hey, I went to that conference, or Great t-shirt. Scott had a single room with a private bathroom in a boys' dorm, but he hated the beer drinkers and football players, so he joined the UVM Pride Suite with a variety of gay undergrads. The following year, he established a 7-person suite for trans people. He went on to start a trans conference at the university, to convince UVM that students should be able to put whatever name they wanted on their student IDs, and to get the designation transgender added to housing forms. I first saw the family soon after Scott began his freshman year. When I went back 2 years later, Scott had moved away from a trans identity and toward an exclusively male one, a gay male one. I still haven't figured out how the person who was my daughter who likes guys is therefore gay, Morris said. In the general population, some men are gay because they are attracted to men, and when they become women, they remain attracted to men. Some men are gay because they are attracted to sameness, and once they become women, they are attracted to women. These are not independent variables. They are components of a complex relationship with one's own and other people's gender. By some estimates, about half of trans women and a third of trans men are gay or bisexual. Lynn said, I asked him lots of questions about how people have sex. He discussed it with me because he was being gracious, and I wanted to know. I worry because there are anatomical things that are different given that he doesn't want bottom surgery. So he's got to meet one hell of a nice guy not to mind. But people have richly varied tastes. During those transition years, I would stop by UVM pretty often for lunch, and we'd talk on the phone quite a bit. In the last year, he's been much less forthcoming. He's doing what a normal teenager does. Scott said, I'm fine being out as gay. But I'm not out as trans except to close friends. For a while, my transition was most of what I thought about and did. I'm no longer interested in making my life like an example. I am probably going to medical school. I know my being out could be important for other medical students who have trans issues. But it's also my life. Scott's younger brother, Charlie, said he didn't have a hard time with his old friends learning that his sister was now his brother. But he has a hard time telling newer friends that his brother used to be his sister. When those friends come over, Charlie puts away the framed photos of Scott as a little girl. Scott doesn't mind his parents having the photos out, and he doesn't mind Charlie putting them away. Lynn said, "If we get rid of them, we erase his childhood. I had a daughter until Scott turned 14. Of course, I didn't have a daughter, really, because Scott was Scott the whole time. But also, I did." I found two models for political engagement among trans people. Some activists were newly affirmed in their gender and eager to claim a loud trans identity. Over time, I saw them become comfortable passing, wanting simply to live the gender they had always felt themselves to be. For them, activism had been a form of catharsis. Others had made their transitions quietly and privately, often at a great distance from everyone they knew and loved. Over time, they became comfortable with themselves and worked to spare others the difficulty they had experienced. For them, activism was a mechanism of gratitude. Many activists associated themselves with organizations such as Trans Youth Family Allies, TYFA, Gender Spectrum Mermaids UK, PFLAG Transgender Network, Trans Family of Cleveland, Transactive, Gender Fork, the National Center for Transgender Equality, the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund, TLDEF, and the Trans Kids Purple Rainbow Foundation. Some activists were not themselves trans, but had an oblique relationship to the trans community. I was especially drawn to two groups that represent the differing archetypes of support for trans children, Gender Spectrum and TYFA. Stephanie Brill, who founded Gender Spectrum in 2007, trades richly in nuance, sometimes at the expense of clarity, but always with an acknowledgement that among human experiences, gender lies at the pinnacle of complexity. She is versed in gender theory and queer theory, and can spin the obscure vocabulary of abstract philosophy into a dazzling array of options for you or for your child. She believes that a just society must have room for boys who like dolls, for heterosexuals who cross-dress at home, for women who are tough at the office and turn kittenish with intimates, for male kids with long hair who want to learn ballet, and for little girls who are interested only in baseball and climbing trees. Kim Pearson and Shannon Garcia, who run TYFA, a group founded in 2006, are equally intelligent, but they are first and foremost mothers of trans kids. Whereas Stephanie Brill radiates intellect, they emanate a Midwestern every mom warmth. They are large and loud women who can finish each other's jokes. You can call them in the middle of the night, and they'll wake up fast and throw themselves into solving your problem. They can sway a high school principal in a conservative small town in middle America by showing that gender variance is a common experience requiring extremely obvious accommodations. They have the kind of courage that makes other people brave. Stephanie Brill is based in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Gender Spectrum helps liberal families proceed through transition with acuity and self-assurance. Brill encourages parents and patients to explore the many places in the gender middle before they commit to a leap from one side to the other. That is an excellent approach where feasible. It is not feasible in the previously mentioned small towns, where shifting from male to female, or vice versa, is already more than anyone is prepared to entertain. Gender spectrum is for families pondering the nature of identity. Typha is for families whose children will kill themselves if they have to live one more day in their natal gender. Kim Pearson and Shannon Garcia met online in 2006. In January 2007, they set up Typha with Amy Guar, another mom who is treasurer of the organization, and Jen Burleton, a trans woman who went on to found Transactive. 10 months later, Amy Guar's trans son, Ian Benson, took his own life. "It has shaped the way we do things," Kim said, "because even a kid who's fully supported is still hugely at risk. Children who come out in adolescence know they may lose parents, siblings, friends. They are already at the end of their ropes. So do not ever assume that you have time as a parent to have your own pity party. You can grieve about your child transitioning to another gender, or you can grieve about your child being dead." After the first of Kim and Shannon's workshops that I attended, the two women engaged an anxious father who said, "But what if he changes his mind?" Shannon said, "You just explained how he told you on the changing table at 2 that he was a girl, and that message hasn't changed in 13 years. You're worrying about the future. Talk to your kid about today, right now." It took them about 10 minutes to bring this man around to an acceptance he had been unable to achieve for over a decade. While most of her work is with parents, Kim Pearson told me that what she finds hardest is helping trans people to keep their dignity. She described meeting a trans woman, Janice, who introduced herself as a post-operative transsexual. Kim replied, "Do you view yourself as a woman?" Janice said she did. Kim said, "So I view myself as a woman, and I've never, ever introduced myself by my genitalia. I'm going to challenge you to introduce yourself as a woman or as a transgender woman and never to discuss your surgery with a stranger again." Adult trans people say they don't want to be judged by what's under their clothes. Well, then stop introducing yourself by what's under your clothes. For some families, transition is harrowing. For others, it is easier. And for some, such as the Pearsons, it's a celebration. Sean Dedrick Pearson, living in a small town in Arizona, came out officially on May 6, 2006, and a few months later his mother started Trans Youth Family Allies, and they boarded a joint bandwagon to change the world. "I'd faced a lot of expectations of how I should be growing up," Kim said. "I didn't want to do that with my kids." At 3, Sean was going, "I don't do dresses." We're like, "If it's going to be a big deal, we'll switch to pants." Nevertheless, her daughter was always unhappy. When Sean was 12, she wrote to her parents that she was a lesbian. Things got better for a little while, then they got worse than before. Sean was failing at school and had constant stomach aches and headaches. "Sean was staying in a dark room with the covers pulled up," Kim said, "not eating or eating constantly, not sleeping or sleeping constantly. You could so clearly tell that something horrible was wrong, but we couldn't figure out what." The Pearsons started family therapy. A few months later, they happened to watch the movie Transamerica, and Sean, then 14, knew the answer. A few weeks after that, Kim and Sean walked into the counselor's office, and the dynamic was changed. "I went in with a depressed daughter, and I came out with a happy son," Kim said. Sean says, "I'm not a lesbian. I'm transgender. I'm totally a guy. You know that's who I am." I said, "I feel like I've been working on a jigsaw puzzle all of your life, and there were some pieces that never fit. Today, I see those pieces just fitting perfectly. But I have no freaking clue what we do now." He just blithely says, "That's okay, Mom. I've got a list." I need a legal name change. I need you to enroll me in school as a boy. And I need to get binders for my chest. Kim, who didn't really want to do any of those things, was horrified. Somewhere in there, he said he wanted to get men's shampoo and deodorant and socks, she recalled. So I said, I don't know how to do any of those.